So now to something completely different. It's not about random numbers at all. It's not about mathematics at all. So it's just about cryptanalysis, which we realized with a cost-optimized FPGA cluster. And what's interesting about this is that a lot of people are speculating about these things, and actually it was never built. So we decided, like at the last year's Sharks conference, that's almost 1.5 years ago, in Paris, to actually build such a thing, because we were discussing recent development in low-cost FPGAs. So FPGAs are these tiny little chips which are kind of reprogrammable hardware, and they're getting cheaper and cheaper. And it seemed to us like a nice idea to just build a really powerful cluster out of this on our own. So it took almost 1 year until we got something which was really running. And that's the one which you see in the background. That's the so-called Copacabana machine. So before I start over, I just have to thank many people. So first of all, there's of course Christoph Paar, so the head of our group, which was motivating us all the time until we got really something really nice and running. So then there are some guys which do a lot of programming, like there's the master student Christian Schleifer, who is currently doing a framework, and it took almost half a year to get all the communication protocols which we have to do and program on our own, running and things like this. Then there's Tim Venezel, who did ECC attack on the same type of FPGA, which I will talk a bit later on. And then there are mainly the two guys from our partner in the Northern Germany, in the University of Kiel, who did actually the hardware layout of this FPGA cluster. So they did more or less the layout, and we did like the programming. And special thanks go to François-Xavier Standard, which is here, which I met today the first time. And we use his famous and really efficient DES core for breaking actually DES. So that's really an efficient, highly pipelined implementation, which is, as far as I know, the best one which you can get. And we use this for breaking DES. And then thanks to Xilinx, which gave us plenty of Spartan 3 devices to play around with. Okay, so what will be the talk about today? So what's the agenda? I will talk first about security versus cost. So when it comes to code breaking, there are mainly two metrics which are used currently. Like one is complexity. Like you look at cryptanalytical algorithms and look at the asymptotic complexity of these algorithms. But if you really want to break something, the only interesting thing is time and money. So how much money do you have to invest to break something, and how long does it take? So we'll talk about security and cost in this sense. Then I will talk about the machine which we call Copacabana, so where the name comes from, turning later on. So what are the main principles of the design of this machine? And then we come to two applications. First, of course, that's DES brute force. So DES, everyone knows DES, it's a data encryption standard, which is quite outdated, but still in use. And with this machine, we can show how efficient special purpose hardware can break codes, actually. But DES is also a prime example for algorithms which are efficient in hardware. So this doesn't apply to every other like crypto system, so it's kind of special. That's why I just talk about another application, that's attack on elliptic curve crypto systems. So don't worry, ECC still is safe, it's even vice versa, so ECC is even safer than we previously assumed. So it's comparable to RSA, it's even better as commonly assumed. Okay, so finally I will give some remarks and outlook. Okay, so let's talk about security of ciphers. So when is a cipher secure? When it comes to symmetric cryptography, we hope, of course, that these algorithms are cryptanalytically strong, and the only way of breaking such a cipher is just trying all the keys. So the only way is the so-called brute force attack, and if you look at key lengths which are used in practice, or which should be used in practice, they just start with 112 bit, which is a triple DES, and usually go up to 256 bit, which is the paranoid setting of AES, which is even too safe, I would say. So in this case, you have to test like 2 to the 112 up to 2 to the 256 keys. And if you look like at the number of atoms in the universe, which is assumed to be 2 to the 280, I guess. So you have like almost as many keys to test as there are atoms in the universe. So it's kind of impossible to do this with conventional hardware in some acceptable time. So it's just no way to do this. Okay, so in practice, however, if you take a look at algorithms which are used, they have like a variety of key lengths. So AS, of course, is not can break it with brute force. DS can be broken, actually, which we will show. RC4 is an interesting example, which is a variable key length. So, for instance, when you are in Europe and you want to buy something at Amazon.com in the US, and you click on the lock down there, you will get mostly 40-bit RC4 encryption, which is quite funny. So it doesn't work from here. So I checked this morning, it was RC4 with 128-bit. But if you are in Germany, you get RC4 with 40-bit. So I don't know why that is. But actually, this can be broken then, surely. And of course, what's also interesting, if you have like AES running on your computer and you use a password for key derivation, then most people who use AES 256, they don't enter a 32 ASCII 8-bit password, they just enter some 8-character password. So even these things could be broken somehow. That's actually what law enforcement is doing. So we've been working sometimes with law enforcement, and they actually do such things. So I just want to get to, they just can get, can break ciphers which use weak passwords. Okay, so you end up with attack complexities starting roughly from 2 to the 50 something and up to 2 to the 200 something. And another topic is, which is not covered by this talk, is the security of hash functions, which is one really hot topic, because actually SHA-1, there were some proposals out there for finding collisions with less than 2 to the 65, I think it's 2 to the 63 is the current proposal. But I don't know if these formula really work. So the question is if one can easily break SHA-1 with finding collisions. Okay, so when it comes to asymmetric crypto, it's quite different, because here we don't have this. Of course, we can also use brute force attacks, but they are not the most efficient way to break these ciphers. Here we have like index calculators for RSA, for example, or for discrete log-based problems in finite fields. So here we have like much, much smarter algorithmic attacks. For instance, if you want to break RSA, we use general number field C for factoring the modulus, something like this. And because of this, because of these efficient attacks, we have to use larger key lengths. So it's commonly agreed that secure key lengths for RSA, for instance, or for Elgamal, they just start with 2,000 bit and above. So in practice, we use like 1,000 to 4,000 bits. And for ECC, which is kind of special, because here we don't have index calculus, at least in the general case, we can use key lengths between 160 and 256 bit. But here also the question is, at least for RSA, what's actually the attack complexity of RSA 1024? So there are no hard numbers like in the symmetric case. That's much more easier. This is much more complicated, as we will see tomorrow, because tomorrow we'll have, like today also, we have several talks on the security of RSA and also on the absolute cost of breaking actually RSA. Okay, so traditionally, if we think about secure crypto systems, we think of complexity of attacks. But actually, that's not the only thing which matters. What actually matters is the cost of an attack. So what do I have to invest? What do I have to pay? And how long do I have to wait until I get the key out of the plain text? So state of the art is we can do with PCs, with clusters of PCs, with some hardware, we can do easily, we can do like 2 to the 50 steps. That's something which is feasible. So you shouldn't use any symmetric cipher less than 50 bit, because it's just unsafe. You can really break this. Unless you have like lightweight crypto, which Christoph was talking about, and it depends on the scenario, but if you want to be safe, you shouldn't use less than 50 bit. You should go like above 80 bit, which is currently infeasible. And we think at least that it's also for intelligence agencies infeasible to break this by brute force. But the big question is, what's in between, like between 50 and 80 bits? How much does an attack cost in this range? So when it comes to conventional PCs, you will recognize that that's not really easy. I mean, everyone is talking about DES, that it's unsafe, it can be broken easily. But we once tried, there was also some law enforcement stuff, we once tried to break DES with PCs, and we just did some paper and pencil work and ended up with 500 years with one PC. So it's not that easy. So here you have to be like, have to have some nice piece of hardware to break things like this, or you have to have some other smart ideas. So the question is, how much does it cost to break these things here? Okay, so when it comes to code breaking, you need massive computing. So that's what you want to use. So there are different flavors of massive computing, of supercomputers, and What you might want to use, if you have a lot of money, you can buy just a Cray, like this one, it's a Cray XD1. You can buy some supercomputers from Silicon Graphics, SRC, and so on and so forth. But usually, if you want to just implement a brute force attack, they're just too smart. You just pay a lot of money for things you never use. So these guys really have a bad, poor cost-performance ratio. So you would never use this for code breaking. It's quite inefficient in a sense. So what's much more efficient is if you use conventional PCs and connect them via a network. So there are also two flavors of how you can do this. First is you buy PCs and use them like as dedicated clients in a network. Then you end up more or less with the same problem than with supercomputers, because conventional PCs usually can do much more than you need. So you just pay for graphic cards and stuff like this, or onboard units which you are not using. So they have also not really good cost performance ratio. But what is interesting, if you have like a big university, if you have a big network, you just use PCs idle time in the background to do, for instance, code breaking. Like one good example is the Berkeley framework for parallel computing, like the Boyne framework. That one is famous for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I guess you have heard about this, the CETI at home project. You could do something like crypto at home, like, or cryptanalysis at home, like code breaking. But there are another problem arises. First, you have to motivate people to take part in these projects. So what's the big deal with cryptanalysis? So why should we break this in with our PCs? And the other thing is, you might not want to these people to know that you are doing like cryptanalysis. So it's not really the best solution for breaking cyber. So that's why we are all here. So the best solution, of course, is special purpose hardware, at least in a sense of cost performance ratio. That's because of the simple reason that if you build a chip which can do only one thing, you don't have like unnecessary parts of it. You just have the best cost performance ratio. But here you also have two flavors of special purpose hardware. We have two flavors, which is you have ASICs, which are really ICs produced for only one purpose. The advantage is, if you produce ASICs, that they are really cheap if you use masses of them, like 100,000. The problem is that they have high non-recurring engineering costs, so it takes at least half a year to produce an ASIC, and it costs at least, for industry, at least 500,000 and up to really get some ASICs produced. So you have to build really plenty of them. That's not really what we do at universities. So the other thing what you could use are field programmable gate arrays, like FPGAs, which we just showed in the beginning. They can just be used off the shelf. And that's what we used for our machine, because you can just buy these guys and just program them. And if something doesn't work, you can just reprogram them. That's really nice. So these two things have a really good performance, cost performance ratio, and are highly suitable for code breaking. And actually, it's now commonly agreed that future crypto systems can only be broken with such special purpose hardware. So we never use PCs for breaking RSA 4000 bit unless the algorithms get much more easier. Okay, so just a nice example which shows the difference between PC-based implementations and special purpose hardware. That's some prime example. DES is really an algorithm which runs perfectly in hardware and doesn't run really nice in software, but it just shows the potential of special purpose hardware. So if you look at the number of DES encryptions and or decryptions on the platform, on a PC and on an FPGA, we see that the Pentium 4, that's this guy here, could do with some implementation, which is quite good, could do 2 million encryptions per second, which is good. So that means like 2 million times 64 bit per second, so it's 128 megabit per second. And such a chip without cooling and all this stuff costs around 80 euro. So when we use an FPGA for the job, with this great implementation of François Xavier, only at 100 megahertz, we can even go faster here, you see that we can do 200 times with many encryptions per second, and the chip costs only half of it. So this just shows that cost performance ratio differs not only on the small factors, but it differs like 2 to 3 orders of magnitude. So here we have really something powerful. We use like chips which only do one single purpose.
Is this a bit sliced implementation or the straightforward one?
That's a straightforward one.
So you
can go up. So I've heard something about 8 million, so times 4 times the one. But you can also go up with this one. So it's kind of, they are kind of equal. So here you can, of course, improve somehow. So the best one I've seen is from Eran Dromer for the PlayStation 3. He used something like, all tricks you can play, and this one was really efficient. So I don't know any absolute numbers, but this one was really very good. But it's kind of special purpose hardware if you do this. If you want to do code breaking, you might want to buy a PlayStation 3. It's really interesting. But leave all this graphics stuff, because that costs just money. Okay, so if you want to solve these problems, what would be an optimal platform based on FPGAs? And then we will end up with this Copacabana platform. So Copacabana, where does the name come from? The first couple of letters come from cost-optimized parallel code breaker, and the other letters are just some letters to make the name easy to remember. So what's in the name? That's Copacabana, and what you are thinking of is Copacabana. That's different. So it just differs in one letter, but it's easy to remember. Everyone remembers this thing, and that's nice. And the other advantage was that there still was the name, the URL was still available, so we could reserve some web page for this. Okay. So what are the design principles? So what we want to do, we want to perform at least 2 to the 50 crypto operations. So our goal was just breaking this. So perform 2 to the 56 crypto operations in, let's say, a couple of days, couple of weeks, or something which is kind of useful. And it should be reprogrammable. So it should be applicable to many other things. So not necessarily code breaking or ciphers, could be also something else. So it should be just some special purpose hardware, but it should be adaptable easily to other problems. Okay. So what we are going to optimize, or what we optimized with this construction of this machine, was the cost performance ratio. And for this, we just picked off the shelf hardware, low cost hardware, like low cost FPGAs, which are dropping in price. And we use, of course, FPGAs which have at least a certain size to enable for decent implementations. Then we wanted to have a modular design for two reasons mainly. First reason is that once the FPGAs, in 5 years change, we can just exchange modules with FPGAs, so we can upgrade. And the other thing is, which was really nice for the last couple of months, once some module fails, we can just replace it and don't have to rebuild the whole machine. And once it comes to production of hardware, then you will recognize that there are a lot of possible failures, and it's really nice if you have a module design, you can just plug in another module which works and remove the old one. Okay, and the other thing was we wanted to have something which was cheap in the sense of material costs and fabrication costs. So we wanted to have something which doesn't cost a million, we wanted to have something which is really available by everyone or affordable by everyone. Okay, so we ended up with a parallel architecture consisting of 120 low-cost FPGAs. The disadvantages of this architecture is that we have no global memory on this device. So the only memory you will have is once you connect this device to a host PC, you will have memory on the host PC. But you don't have memory on the device itself, except for the FPGAs. But there's not much memory in there, 500K, that's it. And we don't have any high-speed communication. We have just a couple of megabits. So we have a bus which is 64-bit, but you can only run it with, say, at most 50 megahertz. That's it. So that's the kind of schematic, if you look at the machine from a structural point of view. So what we have is, that's the box here, that's a backplane. You can just stick in FPGA modules. It's pretty easy. So every FPGA module has, in our case, has 6 FPGAs that might be subject to change in the future, but currently we have modules containing 6 FPGAs, and they are connected on the backplane. We are a 64 data bus, bit data bus, and a 16-bit address bus. And the communication is handled by a controller FPGA, which is connected via USB currently to a host PC. So that's going to change soon, because we picked some controller card that was proprietary, which is not really nice. So we're going to replace this by an Ethernet controller. But anyway, it's just a connection to a host PC, and this guy handles kind of the data in and out. And this one is, of course, easy extendable, so you don't have to use 20 modules, you can use just some modules. And of course, you can also use multiple machines and connect them to a single PC. So it's quite easy. Okay, so that's the first version we built that looks like kind of alpha prototype. And it was, so what you see is you don't see the backplane, but you see all these modules sticking close together, so that's 120 FPGAs. a lot of fans to cool these things down, but actually heat is not a problem. So we were wondering about this as well, but heat is no problem. And of course you see here some controller card, some connection, and so on and so forth. And the version we currently working with is a better version, if you will, so looks much more professional, of course. But the main things have changed, so we have like FPGAs and some connectors. So what's inside such a machine? So it's just a view inside the Copacabana machine. We have the controller board, that's already the new one, like a small board handling the I/O to the outside world. Then we have FPGA modules, so 20 times 6 FPGAs in this case. Then we have a backplane, which is hard to see, so it's just the one below. Yeah, you see like the border of this one. Then we have a power supply, of course, that's only 600 watts, which is completely sufficient. And we have big cables, because in the first version we experienced some voltage drop along the lines. So we use like 3.3 volts. But on the FPGA modules, we have a small power module which converts these 3.3 volts to 1.2 volts, which is needed for the core voltage for the FPGA. And once you have like voltage drops along the line, they don't work anymore. So that was kind of critical. So you need these like big cables, which some of you might have at home for hi-fi. There you need also big cables. Okay, so that's the machine. And as already said, it scales easily. So you can just put multiple machines on top of each other in some 19-inch rack. Okay, so how does the actual FPGA module look like? So that's like a bit hardware design here. So we have the Spartan 3 devices packed closely together. So we have 6 devices next to each other. And they are connected via a standard DIMM module to the backplane. So here we see more or less the 64-bit data bus and the address bus. And what else is can be seen here, that's just some drivers like these latches, which can completely disconnect this module from the bus or connect it. So they are kind of driving the output signals and the input signals to the FPGAs. And here's the connector for the power module, which is needed to scale the voltage for the FPGAs. So that's the schematic. How does it look like? That's the real module, so that's what we are currently using. And again, we don't use like some cooling devices on top of this. It's completely sufficient to have some fans just pushing the air through. That's sufficient. That's quite interesting. Okay, so what does this FPGA module do? So of course, this one hosts the cryptanalytical application. So for instance, key search for GES or computing trails of points for breaking ECC and so on and so forth. What do we have? So we have like these three FPGAs of type Xilinx 1000. So some guys of you might know these with ball grid array packaging. And internally, we can run these devices with up to 300 megahertz. So currently, we run them about 120 to 100 megahertz, but we could go up. The question is if we are able to use like 200 megahertz in the current case, because there are some other issues with routing internally and stuff like this. But actually, you could use 300 megahertz. Okay, these modules can be addressed from the controller side by just setting some address. So you can address each FPGA, each single FPGA can be addressed. You can address certain subsets of FPGA simultaneously, or you can simply address all FPGA simultaneously. That's a big advantage when it comes to programming, because you don't see any flash on these devices. So once you switch off the machine, everything is kind of lost. So it's just like blank, because these are RAM-based, so DRAM-based FPGAs. So once we switch on the power switch, we have to program each device. But this can be done in a couple of seconds, because we can program them all at once. That's quite easy, depending on the application, of course. But for DES, we can program all FPGAs at once. Of course, and we have the other things which I already mentioned, like 64-bit data connection and so on. Okay, so the controller device we are currently using is some proprietary board from Caesars. I don't know if anyone has seen this before. That's not really nice. Some things are not working, and the company claims, pretends it's working, but it's not, and we are really unhappy with this, so we're replacing this one by another one. Doesn't matter, it's just some controller board, costs a few hundred dollars, it's not really expensive. And that's used to program all FPGAs, as I said, individually or all together. And this one is kind of doing the communication with the FPGAs. So we have a simple polling logic. So the FPGA DIMMs themselves, they can't initiate the communication. We simply address from the controller side every single DIMM and ask about the status. So it's a really easy kind of protocol which is running there. And the future version is subject to change, so they will use Ethernet and some embedded microblaze controller inside the FPGA. Okay, what kind of applications can we host? Well, as I said, we can use exhaustive key search of DES. So we could break like ciphers between 56 or like up to 56 to 64 bits. That's something which is really possible with this machine. So 56 ciphers could be broken in a couple of days. That works. And we can, of course, tackle some real-world systems. So one nice example is the electronic travel documents, like the EPAS, the German EPAS, which has an entropy, I think it's even far less than 50 bit. I don't even know the exact entropy. I think it's 40-something. It uses triple DES, but it uses key lengths of 40-something bits, so it doesn't really make sense. But you have to ask the BSI because of this, so I don't know why that is. What we actually broke is Norton Discrete. That's just some old implementation with DES. They had even some flaws built in, so they didn't use the 56-bit completely. They used just 42, I think, because they used passwords as key as input for a key derivation function. And these passwords are should consist only of letters. And even these letters were all converted into upcase letters. So you had like, I think it was 42 bits of entropy. So this one could be even broken with a couple of PCs, looks like really nice, and so on and so forth. So something which is quite interesting is the current scrambling algorithm for PayTV. As far as we know, they currently use 48-bit entropy for the keys. So this one would be also something which might be possibly to break. So, but we haven't programmed this yet. Okay, another thing which was done by Tim from our group in master thesis for the same FPGA, not for Prokopanov, that is breaking elliptic curve discrete logarithm. So solving as the elliptic curve discrete logarithm problems with the parallelized Pollard's row method. So this one works, of course, for much, much smaller curves and used in cryptographic applications. And of course, we'll have some more talks on this about factorization. You could, for instance, implement the elliptic curve method on this platform to support algorithms such as the general number fallacy. So that's another thing which can be done. Okay, so these guys are feasible. And this one is particularly interesting because it gives you a good feeling, good estimate for the security of the curve-based crypto systems. Because here, there have hardly been done any work on hardware-based attacks. So it's really interesting to see how secure the curves really are when it comes to hardware-based attacks. Okay, and this one can be used to improve other attacks. Okay, so let's look at DES brute force attack, which is, of course, quite easy because we simply have to scan all through the whole key space. I think I don't have to talk about the DES. Of course, it's a block cipher with 56-bit key length, so on average, you will have to search a key space of size 2 to the 55. Of course, DES is expired. Now everyone uses AES. No, not everyone, because DES is still in some products. So examples are like encryption products or some legacy products, or even in form of triple DES in the machine readable travel documents, the new ones issued in Germany, for instance. So as we just saw, if we use a standard PC, and if you want to break DES on a standard PC, if you just assume the 2 million keys per second, or we can even take 10 million keys per second, doesn't really matter, you will end up with a few hundred years of computing time. And that was quite astonishing to us, because everyone said, hey, this is insecure, don't use this. But actually, if you see this, it's quite impressive how long it still takes to break DES. So that's why we moved to the special purpose hardware, which we saw in the beginning, because then we can do it for the same price in a couple of days. So the architecture is pretty simple. I think I don't have to go into details. What we have on this specific type of FPGA, we have four DES cores from UCL, these cores, which are completely pipelined. That means they can compute one encryption per clock rate. So every clock rate, we have a complete encryption because it's pipelined. So all in all, we have like four encryptions per clock on a single FPGA. It makes on an FPGA with 100 megahertz, makes 400 million keys. For the hookup of Urbana, that's 48 billion keys per second. And a whole key search, so an average key search, not the complete key search, currently takes around 9 days. And that's subject to improve, so actually this DES core is running at rates far higher than 100 megahertz, so it runs at 200 something. Maybe you two know, you should know how fast this is. Yeah. Since we could hardly fit four machines inside, we optimized the implementation for area, not for time. So I think we can go up to 150 megahertz, something like this. But actually, we will have some days for research. So it will take some days. Okay, so if you compare this to PC-based key search, you would have to buy, to do a key search in 9 days, you would have to buy around 20,000 of these guys here. And that's, of course, much more expensive. Just the same comparison than before, only another scale. So here you have to invest like a couple of million euros or dollars, and this machine, because it's special purpose hardware, only costs a couple of thousand. So that's just just some pictures. That's just a simple output from the application, from the host application. That just shows kind of the status of the Copacabana machine, just to see what happens actually there. So here you see the FPGAs, 1 to 6, or 0 to 5, whatsoever. You see the slots of the DIMM modules, and what you can see is actually the progress of each FPGA. You can see that two slots are currently unused, and you see that in this case here we found one key. Of course, nice picture here. So that's what you actually see if you want to break this. You can just switch on the screen, and it always displays you the current progress, which key space is being searched, the key rate, and stuff like this. So, it's just a really simple interface. I also wrote a web interface for this, which just writes your web page, and you can look if you're at home, look if your machine is still running, which is quite funny, but it's nothing special, it's really easy. So easy to use. You just type in plain text, ciphertext, and this one runs. And once you switch off the machine, you can of course easily resume at the point where you stopped. So just saves all this data. So what's interesting about the price or the cost performance, so if you look at the material costs only, you can see that Moore's law even holds for this stuff. So if you take a look at Copacabana, which costs approximately $10,000, so the materials cost $10,000. If you take a look at Deep Crack, which was built almost 8 years ago, there the material cost was around $250,000. And you can compute kind of the ratio between these two. Moore's law states that the cost of hardware approximately halves every 1.5 year at the same computational power. So in 8 years, that makes like five times halving of the cost. So in our case, we would have to divide $250,000 by 2 to the 5. So we end up with $8,000. So this one kind of proves Moore's law. So it's still better for cryptanalysis at least. So that's quite funny.
You need to take inflation into account.
Oh yeah, okay. And yeah, we should also take power consumption into account. Then it gets really interesting. But you're right, of course. Good. Okay, so just besides brute force, which is an easy implementation, some other implementation which is kind of interesting from a research perspective. I mean, brute force is kind of, everyone knows how to do it, and okay, we have done it, which is interesting, which is a nice fact, but it's not really something new. We knew that this could be done, we did it, fine, but what about the security of elliptic curve crypto systems? That's really interesting, so we use the same machine. And just use other code on this. And if you want to break elliptic curves, we have to look at the so-called elliptic curve discrete logarithm problem, because usually elliptic curve crypto systems rely on the ECDLP. So examples are ECDSA, ECDH, ECMQB, and so on and so forth. So what is that, the ECDLP? Well, we have a generator, like a point P, which is generator of a sufficiently large subgroup of the group of points on the elliptic curve, defined on the elliptic curve. And if you multiply this by a scalar, like a 160-bit number, for instance, you end up with another point, Q, so a kind of hop through the whole group. And the question is, if you only know Q and P, not L, what is L? That's the elliptic curve discrete logarithm. That's all. And there's no efficient algorithm for this. So you can use, for instance, brute force. Just try all multiples of P until you end up with Q. But that's kind of the inefficient way to do it. So if you wanna, if that would be the only way to compute the elliptic curve discrete logarithm, brute force would be infeasible for group sizes of around 2 to the 80, but actually we're using 160-bit curves, so there must be some reason for this. One reason is more or less also inefficient method, but baby step giant step method, which has complexity of time and memory of about square root of the order of the curve. So here you see that you have to use curves of around 160-bit, and the most efficient method is Pollard's row method, which has time complexity of square root of the order of the curve, but you don't need much memory for this. So that's the method of choice, Pollard's row method, and that's subject to be implemented on the FPGA. So of course, what can be seen is that all the attacks are exponential in the bit length of the group order. So the method of choice here is Pollard's row, and that's a variant for parallel processors, Pollard's row. And I just write down what actually happens, because that's quite simple. Does this work? Yeah. So what you're trying to find is, you're just trying to find, stick to this notation, trying to find some points, or exactly two points, for instance ui, which are linear combinations of the points p and q. So your discrete logarithm problem you want to solve is q equals l times p. And the question is, what is L? So what you do is, you just compute many linear combinations of these points, and you try to end up, what do we have here? WJ, something like this. Try to end up with an equality of two points which are generated differently. And if you have something like this, you can simply compute the discrete logarithm problem, because you have like A times P, plus B times Q equals C times B plus E times Q. So we can solve actually the equation. So you have like F A minus C times P divided by E minus B equals Q. So that's actually our L. And this has to be computed modular the order of the point. So once you end up with two points which are equal, you can solve the elliptic curve discrete logarithm problem. But the problem is, if you have one processor, this one is easy, because you can really detect if you have like equal points. You can like use a cycle finding algorithm. The problem is, if you have completely independent processors computing these trails, you will never figure out when two points are equal, because you would have to communicate every single point you compute. And there was a nice idea using the so-called distinguished property of certain points proposed by Osho Bina in 1999. So what they use is, they say, okay, in some point in time we will have a collision, but we won't detect it between two processors, because these processors do not exchange these points regularly or every time. So what they exchange is, like, they exchange so-called distinguished points, which are a certain subset of all points, like a small subset. So whenever a processor ends up at a distinguished point, he sends this distinguished point to a server. Like in our case, Copa Cubana sends a point to a host PC. And when on the host PC two distinguished points are completely equal, we know that they must have, or the type of probability must have been originated from two separate trails. And in this case, we have exactly what we have here. So in this case, we can solve the discrete logarithm problem. So the idea is simply to speed up the Pollard's row method, or to use the Pollard's row method, which is parallelizable. So if you have two processors, it's twice as fast, something like this. Okay. So I'm not going into further details. Here's just a diagram which shows that, of course, special purpose hardware is much better than conventional PCs. So that is the work which was done by Tim Veneso at our group. He implemented this method for the Spartan FPGA, which is inside Copa Cubana. So here you can see that the software reference can produce per second, it's a cluster, can produce per second a couple of million points, can compute a couple of million points per second. Copa Cubana can do, of course, much more. So what does this mean in the end? So that's the important thing. I will stick to this table a few seconds. So what we see is here that, for instance, an elliptic curve defined over an 80-bit field can be broken, or the ECDRP can be solved in like 2 days. If you use Copacabana, it just takes around 2 hours, and so on. But what is interesting, the first standardized curve is one of the smallest standardized curves is defined by the standards for efficient cryptography by the SEC-G. That's a curve over a 112-bit field. And if you want to break this with conventional PCs, you end up with computing for years. But if you use like Copacabana, you are less than 1 year. And if you would build the same architecture into a custom ASIC, you could break this in almost 1 year. And that's quite, almost 1 day, sorry. That's quite interesting. So breaking like ECC with special purpose hardware is, of course, much, much easier. So you shouldn't use like 112-bit curves. But what's also interesting is if you just take bit sizes which we use for current applications, like 160-bit, and you would build an ASIC for this, you would end up with like 10 to the 5 years breaking this curve. And okay, we don't have the money things here, so I think it comes on a later slide. So if you just compute the cost of this, like how much would it cost to break ECC in 1 year, you would have to use like 10 to the 5 of such devices. And actually the outcome is that ECC 160 is far more secure than, for instance, RSA 1024. So if you take, for instance, a look at the Turing device proposed by Adi Shamir to break RSA 1024, which costs around, I don't know, let's say $1 million, you would have to pay for ECC 160, you would have to pay like $20 trillion. So it's much, much more expensive to break ECC 160 than RSA 1024. That was one of the results, which you can actually only obtain if you really implement such a hardware to do actually the computation of the discrete logarithm. Okay, so short conclusions. Of course, DES can be broken in a couple of days, but really low costs. Here we have the effect. So if you want to break ECC with 163-bit, you would spend around $1 trillion, which is quite a lot. So this one will be secure, according to Moore's law, if it still holds, would be secure for even 20 more years. So actually, according to these results, there's no need for ECC 190-something. Of course, it's more secure, but actually you can use 163-bit, that's fine. What you shouldn't use anymore is like ECC 112, except for lightweight cryptography. So this can be broken. Other things which could be broken are, for instance, real-time attacks against this electronic passport, which is currently being issued in all over the world. Things like this can be broken with Copacabana. And of course, which I said in the beginning, we can break weak ciphers or ciphers which have some kind of weakness built in, like a weak key derivation function and things like this. Okay, so the other thing is, of course, that we cannot break AES and RSA whatsoever, 1024, ECC 163, with Copacabana, but the results are quite interesting because once we build such a hardware and once we evaluate such an architecture, we can just do fairly good extrapolation, fairly good estimates for the real cost of breaking such crypto systems. So at least in the case for ECC of our prime fields, we now got a fairly good estimate for the total cost of actually breaking ECC. For ECC over binary fields, there is similar work has been done by the group of Jean-Jacques Gatti. So we want to investigate in the future far more applications, so we're really interested in some new ideas. So if you have some ideas, it would be nice to hear about this. We have several nice ideas too, so we need some more students. So if you know some students which might come to Germany, it would be fine for us. Okay, so we will definitely use this machine to evaluate further architectures. And if you want to have some more information about the device, about the hardware, you can just go to the webpage. Okay, thanks.